They pick me up, put me in the county jail. They pick me up, put me in the county jail.
My name is Kathleen Shannon. Here is the second part of a conversation I had last week with Carbondale Police Chief Gene Schilling and his soon-to-be replacement, Lieutenant Kirk Wilson. You can find the first half of our conversation on kdnk.org.
That brings me to a question, sort of what you just said, when the last time you used force was on a woman who was having mental health issues. One of the things I've been reading sort of in the recent literature is that, you know, I think people are looking at policing systemically right now, you know, across the nation. And essentially one of the things I read is police officers are relied on for too much, you know.
I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. So
because if you can't figure out what to do, who do you call? Doesn't matter what it is.
Well, and also just, you know, you can only be an expert in so many things. So I read in, I think it's Seattle or Oregon, they actually, like, the dispatchers may change the call over to mental health experts instead of police. And I think that's a really interesting way of looking at different options of sort of getting people the help that is most appropriate for them. Yeah. Is that something you guys think about, are able to do?
I can answer that.
Okay, great.
So this year, well, last year, 2019, we applied for and received a grant that funded, helped fund two clinicians from the Hope Center. And some agencies, I think Pitkin County was able to be part of a pilot program, actually got to be have some that were full-time employees, which in the Seattle area with a larger population and probably a larger resources, they could probably do that. The way we have to do it is partnership with them. So if it's a mental health call, the officers, either en route if they already know, or once they get there, call mental health professionals that meet them there to do whatever they need to do. Because you're right, I can go to the scene of someone that's threatening to commit suicide, but I don't have the knowledge and or training to say they can tell me, no, I was just messing around. I don't know the difference. You know, I have to believe what my feelings say, that they're telling me the truth or not. So this is one of the things that I think's been really great, is to have that to where we at least have people that will go with us and respond when we have mental health crisis or people in mental health crisis. And not only is it good for the person that might be in mental health crisis, but one of the other things they'll do is if there's a significant incident that happened, they will come out and talk to the family, because a significant incident, whatever it is, affects the family too, and they may be in a mental health crisis or need or something else. And I think that's a very important point. Kirk can answer this, but I think the other part of it is we're in that same situation. And a lot of times we're macho and we don't need to go see the counselor, you know. But I think more and more that we do need to go see the counselor as things progress. And Kirk has talked to me about, I think that he is going to have a policy that officers have to meet yearly or some time period with a mental health professional. Just because they need to be able to have that, and that makes our officers more competent in the field so that we know that they're okay.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. That affects so much. So officer suicide rates are higher than we've seen.
Do you mean nationally or locally?
Nationally. Not certainly. But it also, if an officer is going through a hard time at home, you know, a divorce, a potential divorce, financial issues, we don't want our officers coming in here, being called out onto the street to fix an issue, a problem, using split-second decision-making skills, and their head is clouded. We just don't want that to happen. So doing a full healthcare checkup. So we go to the doctor yearly, and we make sure at least yearly and get a checkup, make sure our blood pressure is okay and whatnot. But we also want to make sure that they are doing okay mentally as well. And that makes for much better decisions in the field.
Mm-hmm. I am curious to how both of you are feeling with sort of just what's happening in the country with police going head to head with civilians. And, you know, I guess it depends on what people are watching and what kind of media they're consuming, but it's ugly out there.
Yeah.
I'm curious how you guys are feeling. And I've heard, I think, a couple times you say that you feel like you don't connect with the officers who are doing that kind of force, and that's not your job. But, you know, to a civilian, people are all wearing the same uniform across the country.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know how it feels personally for you to be seeing that.
So it's a nation of states. So all of the states have different rules, number one. So Colorado has the Peace Officer Standards and Training, Colorado Post. They oversee training for police officers and certification for police officers. I don't know about Minnesota, and I've got the same questions about Minnesota now, because I have a friend that's up in St. Paul, and I'm concerned for him. But here in Colorado, so you have state statute of what officers, how an officer operates, and then Colorado Post has more strict, you know, what in the police academy is required to teach, what law enforcement individual agencies are required to teach annually or within every 5 years. And then you get down to each agency has their own training requirements as well. And that's just training, let alone policies, let alone the culture of the community. And I think one thing that Chief Schilling and I are very passionate about is this agency will be reflective of our community. You know, it kind of goes back to what Chief Schilling was saying earlier, is officers here in a small agency, like, we're really not technically considered a small agency across the country, but agencies our size, bad apples stick out like sore thumbs. Just like if you go to a small grocery store or a small business, if you ask the employees there who are the great employees and who aren't, they don't have to say anything, but they know who that person is. They stick out in small communities like ours. And we're a very transparent agency. I would say the majority of agencies up and down the valley do their best to be transparent. They're small, so we don't have a whole lot of staff. So sometimes it's difficult to get things out as quickly as possible. I'll say getting my statement out yesterday, walking in the front door on Monday and getting that statement, I've been asked a few times, why did it take so long? I'm new. I'm new here, and I'm going around town. I mean, there's a lot of things going on because we wear so many hats. So each agency and each community has its own identity, and I think when you start looking at larger communities, those agencies tend to lose kind of the sense of the community, the sense of the culture of their community. And that's difficult, and I don't know how to solve that. I wish I did. I will say this, that officer that sticks out like a sore thumb here, they're gonna be headed down the road. They're not going to stay here long. Agencies that have strong unions or personnel policies or laws or state laws that really protect personnel, it's much more difficult to get rid of those employees. And so sometimes you see those employees transferred a lot. So in a large metropolitan police department, they don't stay in one spot because that supervisor, that area, they know they can't get rid of them because of whatever, you know, X, Y, and Z, but they get transferred. And they get transferred a lot, and it's not their choice. And so one thing that the state of Colorado is looking at is potentially getting some law that goes through that allows an agency to report that to Colorado Post, so that now when another police department is potentially going to hire this employee that has had a troubled past, now the outgoing agency is able to say more than just what law says we can say, what HR guidelines would say is that that employee was employed here from this date to this date, and that's it. So I'm very supportive of stuff like that, because it should have a mutual benefit, not only to agencies our size, but agencies that are, you know, thousands of officers.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you want to add to that?
I don't enjoy seeing it. I just, you know, it really bums me out, because over the years, the trust in law enforcement has degraded. And it's mainly because of a lot of different bad actors over the years. And, you know, that's not who the majority of us are. We're getting judged by a few. And unfortunately, if you turn on the news, the majority of the stuff you see, not only in the police world, is what someone did bad. It's very rarely that you see what something did good, someone did good.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, because exactly what you're saying, I feel like I could flip and say that's probably how people of color feel, is that the bad stuff is being represented, yeah. Not the yeah. good.
And you know, there's a lot of, I don't know if I should even go into this, but you know, they talk about racism, and no matter where you are, it's there. But here is a lot different than other places. And there's places in the United States that it's still rampant. And you see a lot of this. When we became a largely Latino community, you know, we had that influx. We had a lot of issues with people that didn't accept them. Not as much as something like that, because in a small community, people work in better than that. But I think one year, about 5 years ago, our kindergarten class was 86% non-English speaking as their primary language. They, whoever they is, think that our population right now is real close to about half and half. I think that depending on who you talk to, it's like 46-54, but it could be either way, whether it's Anglos or Latinos or whatever it is. So, did I answer the question, or did I go on a tangent?
Yeah, no, I mean, that gives perspective for sure. I think the bigger problem, from what I can glean with Latinos and police, is like this connection with ICE, especially under the current administration, where ICE has ramped up. You know, their numbers have ramped up and sort of their arrests have ramped up, you know, and it's just a lot more visible with camps at the border, et cetera. Policy-wise, do you have to report to ICE under certain circumstances as a arresting?
Not policy-wise.
Okay. Do you?
We do not have a policy that says that you report anything to ICE about undocumented people. Because that is one of the big things, that is one of the another areas of, if you start doing that, then you lose that community trust again.
Yeah.
Because we have a lot of undocumented people here. And our job, we aren't immigration authorities. We would cooperate with federal authorities, whether it be drugs or guns or immigration or whatever. If they had some enforcement that they needed us to assist them in, we would cooperate with them. And usually, if we had that, which we haven't for a while, is we would kind of want to be the lead. Example, there ICE people sometimes, and sometimes drug people, they get these no-knock warrants and go and kick a door in and go into someone's house. Well, that's not the way that we would want to do stuff. The other half of that is we try and foster those relationships so that if they have something going on here, they really don't have to tell us. They have authority. But we try to foster those relationships with those people so that they will tell us. And if we have those relationships, we can say, hey, this is whoever lives there, we know them, because there's somebody here usually in our department knows someone that knows someone. And will you let us take a crack at this? We think that we can go and knock on the door and get these people to cooperate rather than having to go and kick the door down and go in, guys with black suits and AR-15s in their hand, going into someone's house. So we try to keep those relationships and foster those relationships so that if they do have to come and do some enforcement action here, you know, we can help them and make it better for our residents. Three or four years ago, we actually worked with ICE because there was a couple people living in town who had committed murder in Mexico. The Mexican authorities had issued arrest warrants for them, and they wanted them so they could take them back to Mexico. And we worked with ICE to locate those people and go and take them into custody. I mean, with ICE. ICE took them into custody to get them transported back to Mexico to face charges. So we have those relationships, and those are the kind of people we probably don't want in town, you know. Mm-hmm. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Did you want to add anything about ICE?
Yeah, I am not interested in being an extension of federal enforcement, especially when it's policy enforcement or non-criminal enforcement. So just... if a warrant simply says that we're interested in arresting someone because of an immigration violation, not interested in participating in that, as far as our officers going out and like Chief Schilling was saying, we're not going to kick in doors over something like that. If it's a criminal warrant, just like in a murder scenario, then absolutely we're going to work with them to bring that to resolve that situation at our level, the way that our community wants us to handle that. But we won't be an extension of administrative type of issues, specifically referring to immigration. So we're part of our community, and we need to know that when they need help, whatever part of our community, when they are in time where they need to call someone and get help, we want them to call us and not fear that we're going to take them away from their families simply for those issues.
And the town actually passed a resolution two or three or four years ago that said that basically the police will not take action unless it's a criminal arrest warrant, because if it's a criminal arrest warrant, we have no choice.
Yeah.
We are required, says right on there, you will take into custody, and it's a judge's order. And if we don't, then it's for us to go to see the judge and tell him why we didn't take that person into custody. So other than criminal warrants, it's pretty much no.
Okay, great. There's a couple more things I want to touch on. This one I just honestly don't know the answer to. Obviously, police in cities have access to, you know, military-grade weapons and defense things to wear. I'm not sure what the terminology would be. Do you know how it gets decided what communities have access to that? You said earlier that you don't have tear gas, that you don't have...
Yeah, I think it's up to the... The access is different than possessing. So is your question, do we have access to it? Yeah.
So if you wanted it, you could request it.
Yes.
But you don't have to.
Or we could purchase it. The items we have in reference to that is officers are issued and do have AR-15 rifles or a variation of that. And the purpose of that is that there's sometimes you have situations where that type of weapon is needed. Barricaded suspect is a first thought that comes to mind. You know, handguns in that situation aren't usable. We may come in contact with someone who is using one of those weapons to shoot at the officers, and we have to take enforcement action. So we do have those, and officers train on them several times a year and qualify with them on them at least twice a year. The other non-lethal stuff that we have other than tasers and that is we have shotguns that fire beanbag rounds. We've never had to use them, but we do have them. And they're a non-lethal option. And they're a lot different than rubber bullets. Rubber bullets are, so to speak, more of a projectile. And beanbag rounds are kind of bigger. And so we have those, but we have never used them, but we train on them. I think outside of that, we have just normal, like, police stuff. Like I said, we don't have tear gas or rubber bullets or that kind of stuff.
And along those lines, I wanted to just really hash out the training. I heard you say that you do monthly de-escalation training.
Correct.
Are there other, like, specialty trainings that you do? And I'm specifically thinking about, like, racial bias training. Yes,
and we do that. And it's also required by state law that we do that. And I don't know what the renewal period is.
Once every 5 years per the state.
It's required by the state. And along that, we also have monthly trainings, anti-bias, driving, arrest control, policies and procedures, de-escalation. There's a lot of those that we have different short monthly trainings on to keep officers up to date. And then, like I said, we have during the year or every so often we have, you know, more in-depth trainings of those. So like the officers spent 4 hours Wednesday, not all of them, but some, with arrest control training. And so that's, you know, right now especially is important, but that's an ongoing thing. Over the next, between June and July, that's scheduled 6 times for officers to attend. Different officers will go at different times, but the training's out there. So training is a big thing.
Can you define for me more what arrest control means? I don't really, you know, I don't know.
It's how you arrest someone.
So when you're in training, what are you learning?
Anything from how to properly put someone's in handcuffs to take them down, what not to do, like the chokehold, you know, these are things that you don't do. So anything that would involve an arrest, you know, holds that, like someone that's in the bar, that's not being cooperative, that the bar people went out, there's arm holds that you can do to escort them out of the bar. But then it goes all the way to a felony car stop where you have a suspect that you need to do it that's committed a felony. And there's different ways to do that type of an arrest versus like a DUI driver, so to speak, or a domestic violence arrest. So they train all of they try to train in different scenarios of the proper way to do stuff and things that you don't do.
Can you give me some examples of de-escalation methods?
De-escalation is all verbal. Gotcha. You know, de-escalation is all verbal. We don't want to do this. Will you please cooperate with them? You know, that all that de-escalation is verbal.
Okay, great. Who's,
any disagreement?
Oh, sorry.
No, I would certainly say one thing I would want to make absolutely clear is this is an agency that the state has certain requirements, and they're fairly low in general terms, how many hours to train in firearms, driving, arrest control, de-escalation, anti-bias. This is an agency that goes well above and beyond what is required. And that's because we choose to do that, which is a fantastic opportunity to step into.
Great.
I would say, you know, so understanding your own implicit biases is key, is huge, because we all have them, regardless if we want them or not, we've got them. But having that better understanding and having more data-driven options to kind of figure out, okay, now once I know this about myself, now what? I think Chief would be able to offer up more of what's actually been going on. But I know that our officers are we're one of the top trained agencies you're going to find. And so that's if it's not part of our current program, it will be.
I just say we try all the time, and we try to be mentors to our community, and the community tries to be mentors to us, and we want to let people know that even though this is going on around the nation, we don't believe that we have any staff like that, and we're here to help.
Thank you for listening in on my conversation with outgoing Carbondale Police Chief Gene Schilling and his incoming replacement, Lieutenant Kirk Wilson. You can listen again or share this conversation on kdnk.org. For more on local police training and budgets, tune in to the local newscast tomorrow right here on KDNK.
They picked me up, put me in the car.